hopefully as people file in, they'll find a seat and join in the conversation. My name is Chris Sharon, and I serve the village as an assistant for program, especially working to help coordinate teaching staff. This forum format depends on having some yeast for our bread, having some starter people that get our conversation going. So we've invited three people to offer reflections on our forum topic, which loosely comes from the title we've proposed, Who Cares About Families? And the reason that we picked out the religious right as language for the forum is because we explicitly wanted to talk about the debate that's going on in the public realm. And the religious right is certainly a curious term because it refers to a number of different factors in our society, but it's a way at least for us to say there is a public debate going on and there are very interested parties and organizations contributing to that debate. And so we wanted to talk about that. We wanted to ask, are there important questions in the debate that's going on? Are helpful strategies being suggested in the debate that's going on? So hopefully through this discussion tonight, we'll start getting at some of those issues. And I don't expect we'll solve most of them. But one of the good things about holding forums is that we get a lot going in the hour that we're together. And those conversations can continue later on in the coffee. It's not a coffee shop, but I kind of think of it that way because it's always open. The coffee pot's up in the dining hall, or conversations can continue on the trails or wherever. The forum will start with about 4 minutes or 5 minutes from each of our panelists, and then I'll moderate people's either comments or questions or stories that they want to contribute to the conversation, and ask that you please raise your hand so that we can make sure that each person who speaks is honored and that other people aren't trying to speak at the same time. And as the conversation goes along, I'll try and call on people or invite people to speak who haven't spoken yet so that we get a rich diversity of opinions from the group. And I encourage you to disagree if you feel like disagreeing, because we'll all be the richer if we don't come out at the same place in the discussion. So I think that sets some of the ground rules and the hopes for the forum. And we've asked Jack Nelson Palmer, who's here this week on teaching staff, to lead off for us. And so I just ask each of our panelists to briefly introduce themselves and then share with us what they have to share.
I'm Jack Nelson Palmer. I'll be doing a series next week, 5 sessions on Is the Religious Right Wrong About Family Values? And just a couple of stories and then a couple of kind of, I guess, comments to try to maybe frame how we think about this discussion. I'll tell you, first of all, you've probably seen me wandering around with my 3 children here. Hannah is 8, Audrey is 6, and Naomi is 3. So I come at this topic through the lens of a parent who really is struggling with how to raise children responsibly in a world that's breaking apart. And how do we do that without simply pulling our own children away and trying to create a nice life for them apart what's going on in the world? So how to live in the world. The second kind of background comment would be, 2 summers ago, I was asked by the Fellowship of Reconciliation to address a major conference. And it was the first time in my life that I was ever asked to talk about what was going on in the country and the world through the lens of a parent and through the lens of what was happening to children in our society. And I did that, and I can honestly say in 15 years of doing public speaking on a number of different issues over the years, I got more positive feedback on that particular talk of any that I had ever given. And the conclusion that I drew from that is that there are a lot of people in this country who believe that family values are important, that the values discussion is important. But there's a lot of people, myself included, who are very troubled about leaving the framework for that debate with the religious right. There's a kind of political meanness that is following, in my judgment, that is following that conversation about family values that is of great concern to me. So what I've tried to do in this book that you'll find in the bookstore is called Families Valued, It's a play on words, obviously. I'm not trying to say that family values aren't important, but I'm trying to say that the real issue for me is, what would we do differently as parents and as society if we actually cared about children? A quick story. When I was writing this book, Naomi, the youngest, before she was three, got into this pattern for a couple of weeks where she would wake up in the middle of the night and just scream at the top of her lungs, "Dad!" And it meant, "Get your butt over here right now!" You know, and so you'd race in there in the middle of the night. It was almost 3 o'clock every morning for about 2 weeks. Finally, we were just exhausted, taking Naomi up to bed, and I said, "You know, Naomi, moms and dads really need their sleep, and best of all, you know, is a full night's sleep, uninterrupted sleep." And she looks at me directly and she says, "Dad, my dreams are full of troubles." And I thought, boy, what a powerful statement that summarizes for me what a lot of us feel as we look to the future of our children. Our dreams are full of troubles. Lots of families are living a nightmare in our society today. And lots of us that are better off and doing reasonably well, I think, are really fearful of the future. And that insecurity that a lot of people feel about the future, I think, is really feeding a mean politics in this country. What I want to do to help frame the debate tonight, or at least ask you to think about, and I'll be talking about this next week for those of you who are around, is I put a point A here and a point B. And I want you to think about that as a continuum. And I want you to think about where you would place yourself in relation to two sentences I'm going to read. You know, if we were going to make this point A and that point B, I'm going to read two statements and just think about where you would stand, where you would place yourself on the continuum. Because I think it's helpful, let me just tell you the two sentences, that I think kind of encapsulates where we are in a public debate right now. Point A, how many of you would place yourself over here? The breakdown of the family is the principal cause of many key social problems such as crime, poverty, and teen pregnancy. Okay, that's one point on the continuum. The breakdown of the family is the principal cause of many key social problems like crime, poverty, and teen pregnancy. Then, other side of the continuum, B, how many of you would say poverty is the principal cause of family stress and family breakdown? Point B, poverty is the principal cause of family stress and family breakdown. I think those are very, very important kind of places where we can stand in relation to this debate. And I would say that while family values are very, very important, how we raise our children, how we teach them to be respectful, all of those things are really important. If we look at our society compared to other societies, we see that the U.S. does incredibly poorly relative to all the other industrial countries. The United States doesn't show up in the top 10 in any indicator of child welfare. In Sweden, for every 100 children who live in poverty, after government intervention, only 7 of them remain poor. In the United States, for every 100 children who are in poverty after government intervention, 93 of them remain poor. So there's all kinds of things that we need to look at. Last thing, opening comments, is I find actually more helpful than this placing myself on the continuum, although I will do that next week, is to think about what's happening to families in our society in relation to three circles. And you see that these circles in this wonderful drawing that Chris did, you see that they overlap much better than my drawing. But if we think about a family circle, what happens within a family obviously has a tremendous impact on children, right? I think we'd all agree with that. So, a family circle. The second one is a neighborhood circle. You know, ask yourselves, why have you chosen to live where you live, right? And then, I live in an urban neighborhood in Minneapolis that struggles with lots of issues. I don't know how many of you come from that kind of neighborhood, but I will tell you, a neighborhood matters. I live in Minneapolis, Minnesota, which everyone thinks is a beautiful city, where more than half the children live in poverty, where 60% of the students in public schools live below poverty. So the neighborhood circle is very, very important, it seems to me. And the third one is the broader kind of, what would I call it? Let's see what I wrote down here. Yeah, the larger society. What's happening? Is there a relationship between the fact that in the 1980s we had the largest transfer of wealth in the history of this country from poor and working class citizens to the upper 1% of the population? Is that part of the family crisis? Is the fact that the U.S. has the highest gap between the rich and the poor of any other industrial country and it's growing more quickly here than anywhere else, is that part of the family crisis? Is the fact that one out of every five full-time workers in this country lives in poverty? Is that part of the family crisis? So all of these circles for me are really important. And what I try to do in this book is to say those of us who are reasonably well off, generally speaking, are doing a very poor job raising our children, making choices. Children abandoned to Nintendo have a lot in common with children abandoned to mean streets. So from my vantage point, if we were to take the crisis of children and families seriously, it really requires us to rethink everything. All of our personal choices, our personal priorities, and all of our social choices and social priorities.
Thanks.
Hi, I'm Sonia. I'm an author,
artist, maybe?
Yeah, oh, sure. Just briefly, I'm the gardener here, I'm on long-term staff, and I'm glad to be a part of this forum. I come from a background that includes the religious right. I come from a very conservative family, and I come from Wheaton College in Chicago, an alumni. Some of you will know that, you know, familiar, others might not. It's the stronghold of evangelicalism in the Midwest. it's a great place, but it's not quite the place that many people think it is. It's associated highly with the right. Most people, you mention the name, they say, "You live by all those rules over there? Oh my gosh!" I was really amazed in my 4 years there of the diversity of opinion that I came across. And but I struggle because the right is significantly represented there, and I struggle with dealing with people around me, friends, peers, people I went to church with, who were part of the whole right and the thinking, and who were responding to issues that are real in society and that need the attention of Christians and of caring Christians and socially responsible people, but their responses just were deeply saddening and disturbing and seemed to me to reflect, in the end, to reflect ill on the kingdom of Christ. And we've all done that, our actions, each of us, you know, there's sin in all of us. But so my struggle as a part of that community and now as an individual and as a part of this one is to how to embrace the issues and how to come forth with what we believe in a way that represents Christ well and that glorifies God, that doesn't tear down the body, but that doesn't alienate and isn't this political meanness that Jack spoke of. And that's really tricky because they're tough issues. The biggest thing that I have come to realize that arguing with my peers and with those people really doesn't do much good. That is counterproductive as Christians for us to be constantly saying, this is where we're different, we don't agree with the religious right, to constantly be pointing out our differences and alienating ourselves from them because we're breaking apart the body of Christ and we're showing to others, to non-Christians in the world, a very confusing picture and one that doesn't reflect well and doesn't want encourage one to want to be a part of that body. But it's hard because we have differences, and all of us here probably look at the modern issues differently. So finding common ground isn't always easy. And what I'm encouraged to do myself is to try and talk with people about the values from which my positions stem, the values and the worldviews and the theological beliefs, to impress those upon people around us, other Christians in the world. And from them, I think we can come to a lot more common ground because I think we do uphold a lot of the same values and we book probably talk about that quite a bit. But it's very challenging when interpretations are so different. But I'm encouraged that if we could try and have other people understand us more than try and always convert them to our opinion and throw our issues out there and try and be swinging political pendulums, that we'd be doing ourselves, the church, a greater favor if we were trying to communicate why our values, why do I believe this about the life issue? Why do I believe this about poverty and about the social problems? What's the source of my energy for wanting to be a part of the issue? Why do I care? To talk about that and why we care about the issues, I think would be more impressive to the world around us. So I guess I come from the point that there's a lot to learn from the religious right. They have good things, good issues that they're talking, good questions that they're throwing out. And I think questions and issues like, do we have committed families? Are we teaching our children commitment? And are we living that out daily? Those are good issues, which they're talking about. It doesn't necessarily mean we need to buy James Dobson books for our kids. I have enough of those. But are we living out what we believe? And are we teaching the kids that they're great, that they're wonderful? Are we rooting them in identity in Christ rather than in something else? Do we affirm our kids enough so that they don't turn to awful things, our social ills, so that we can't take everything ourselves, but so that they don't turn to eating disorders, to gangs, to crime, to increased promiscuity? There's all these problems, and I think, from my experience that I've seen with peers and friends, that a lot of stuff is rooted in perception of self, the values, and the idea of self you have for your family. So I think that's a great task that we have ahead of us as people, and as myself, as a potential parent of the century or whatever, you know, the next century, to really, you know, it's a huge challenge. I'm so impressed to, you know, I'm only 23, and, you know, I'm so young, but as I've gotten older, I've seen that parenting is an enormous task, and I'm encouraged by what I see here and other places. And yeah, I guess that's all I gotta say.
Thank you.
My name is Maury Wheat. I'm a parish pastor in Moorhead, Minnesota. And I think in this discussion, the way that this has been framed, I'm probably, you should look on me as the what they used to call the man in the street, that they would stop and say, what do you think of this thing? because I feel I'm here to learn about how these questions are being framed politically. And I've got a few things to say about that in a minute. But first of all, I want to say that 14 years ago, I came to Holden with a six-week-old baby. And when I was here, my wife and I did a forum on parenting.
Did you destroy that tape?
That's the last time I've ever tried to say anything authoritatively on that subject. As the forum went on, I could see the twinkles in the more experienced parents' eyes, and I understand that really well now. I think it's very hard to get a handle on ideal models for parenting, or what it takes to create an environment where kids grow up happy and healthy. That one is 14 now, and I have an 11-year-old and a 7-year-old. Birthday is tomorrow. And I'm like every parent, and most likely every person in society, I'm really concerned about families, about the raising of children. I find the discussion, the phrases, family values that you hear, quite confusing and unhelpful. And I think that I want to speak somewhat from my experience as a pastor, that it doesn't make any sense to me to say that, for instance, poverty is one of the central factors in difficult family dynamics or problematic kids. You don't have to look around very far in the suburbs and the affluent suburbs to see very troubled families, very troubled children. There are lots of other factors that are also really significant in what makes parenting hard. And when I look at the families in my congregations, it's virtually impossible to predict by looking at the parents and their values and how they work at raising their children, what's going to become of their children. I find it's astonishing to me what a wide range of possibilities there are, and I feel so silly about my own self-confidence when I was a new parent, and how Christine and I were going to raise these kids in ways that were somehow going to be new and different, and we're going to work so well. I'm really humbled by that, the whole experience of working at that. I do think that we've got a major issue in our society, and that I think we have a society that doesn't like children, and we communicate that to them in many ways. And if you look in your congregations, sometimes congregations are relatively inhospitable to squirrely kids, to crying babies. Sometimes kids come there and feel like it's not a place for them. If you talk to the parents, you go into any congregation, you're going to find a lot of people who care very deeply about the youth program. And if there's a trouble spot or a nervous spot that people have, 50%, 80% of the time it's going to be the youth program, because people know that raising children is very difficult work. Maybe that's not exactly at the core of the family values issue, raising children, but probably pretty close to it. Anyway, congregations all care deeply about it, but we're living in a culture that communicates to children that we don't particularly like them. I know a situation where a pastor had a new baby and brought the baby to work occasionally, set up a crib in the corner of her office, and the rest of the staff seemed to resent this. People in the congregation wondered if this was really appropriate, and made it very difficult for her to figure out how she was going to do this, how she was going to go on being a pastor and a parent. And I think that, that would be true of many other lines of work. It's true in, you go into public spaces, and our culture prefers that you don't bring children along. If you're going to be at the opera, I suppose you can go to a baseball game, and that's fine. But there are lots of public places where children are made to feel uncomfortable, and I think that's the kind of thing that runs across the board, whether you're impoverished or wealthy, whether your politics tend to run to get far left or far right.
Thank you. Well, three different and very rich perspectives, all raising the fact that this issue is dear to their hearts, and I imagine dear to many of your hearts. So if you have questions for any of the three, or comments or stories of your own to add, please, I invite you to jump into the discussion, and we'll see where we go.
Well, I'll start.
Sure.
And I'll start by saying that I believe strongly that I'm on the side of A of E, because I raised my children, my two daughters, as a single mom for a lot of years at very little income. And at that time, I didn't make a lot of money because I didn't have a college education. And I did have skills, but they didn't pay a whole heck of a lot. What I had going for me at that time during those years were some very stable programs that helped keep us above water. I was able to buy my home, a home of my own, under a housing program from the federal government that cost me 25% of my income for all the years I was raising my girls. I had my child care that was covered because my income was not such that I could pay for the out-of-pocket child care. I didn't qualify for food stamps, but that wasn't necessary because I lived in the Willamette Valley and there was always lots of cleaning programs. And there were programs that the government had in place that said I didn't have to worry about a roof over my head. I didn't have to worry about the quality of child care for my children, my two daughters, and I didn't have to worry about food. Now, the basic, and we had a heck of a good time. I was spending very little money. The second thing that I had going for me all those years was my church family. And my both of my daughters say, my oldest was educated at PLU because, although I still wasn't making a whole lot of money, there were people that helped her with the scholarships and the programs and grants for her to be college educated and now going out and in service. But I had people within my church family that were very positive role families that right from the very beginning looked and said, here's something that I can do to take an interest in my daughters. We had pastors, we had pastors' wives, and a lot of people. And I believe that there's a poverty in terms of, and the questions that we should be asking the people that are talking about, gee, what are we going to do for the family, is number one, where are those program dollars going? Where's our congregation looking in terms of supporting the family? And I'd also like to say that in terms of, because we're talking about the religious right, well, I come from the state of Oregon that, you know, that probably is more to the to the left, you know, left, right, I kind of mixed up my directions. But we have two excellent programs in Oregon that I'm very proud to share. And one is that a little over 3 years ago, the state enacted legislation that was established an organization called the Oregon Commission on Children and Families. And this program was designed at the state level and funded at the state level to look at those at-risk families that are having all these problems that we hear about every day. What can the state do? And they in turn went from the state and established local commissions on children and family throughout the 34 counties in the state of Oregon. And those counties are each looking locally at what organizations, including the church, that can support the family and to give the needed care from the, you know, the infants on up. And it's working. It's working very, very well. And in the communities itself, we established for the last 2 years, taking a keen look at what can the community do to support the families in the church, in our places of worship, in our organizations, and as people. And I'm very proud of the program because it is showing results. And it's something that we can ask each of our, I really believe in grassroots politics, that says, hey, you know, just a minute, I live in the state capital, so that helps. We can talk to our legislature and say, wait a minute. And so that's what I wanted to contribute to the conversation, some really good results that are happening.
Thanks. In my internship congregation last year, we would have called that a testimony.
So,
thank you.
Thank you.
Other people who want to jump in or respond or share another story?
I've got a kind of a program that I want to mention something about at some point, and so while you're thinking about that, I'll add this. And I make a plug for an outfit called Search Institute that's been starting up in some towns a program or set of programs called the Healthy Community Initiative. Some of you heard of these things? The city of Northfield, Minnesota has had this going now for several years, and turns out I just moved from there to Moorhead, and the city of Moorhead also has the same thing going on. And to say very briefly how it works is that it's very inexpensive, but Search Institute comes in and gives a survey to all the kids in 6th grade and 12th grade and publishes this. And they say most of their communities come out within very close range of one another on a lot of different scoring. But what they then, they interpret this to the community, and what they liked, what they propose is that instead of looking at the most presenting problems, let's say teen pregnancy or alcoholism or the kinds of problems that we've seen that we worry about among our youth, they have found that people get really frustrated not knowing what to do on that score. But they have identified 30 of what they call assets in the lives of young people. Assets like knowing an adult other than your parents whom you trust. Eating at least several meals a week with your family. Kind of simple-minded things, you know. And they've identified a number of these that the community can provide, some that the individual family can provide. And they've shown by their studies that kids who have increasing numbers of these assets have dramatic drops in at-risk behaviors. So instead of having everybody focus on these five at-risk behaviors that we worry about, they say instead, befriend a young person and you're adding to their assets, which will then reduce their at-risk behavior. And it's very dramatic in their statistics how radically it reduces the at-risk behaviors if young people have over 20 of these 30 assets present in their life. And they're all fairly simple things to do, and they're positive things to do. So you can say, okay, here's a positive thing to do, instead of saying, what am I going to do about drinking? So it's a kind of a paradigm shift about how you go at helping youth grow up happy and healthy in your community. And once you get the word out about it, you find, well, there are these things going on. You know, this church is doing that, and the Y is doing that, and some place is doing that. And you publicize to adults how they can participate, and you can get the whole village raising the child.
Just two sentences to follow up on that. There's a group in Chicago that's been involved in grassroots neighborhood development for many, many years that has basically kind of developed a similar kind of strategy where they say the general way that we look at what's going on in neighborhoods is by assessing their problems. And they say that's very appropriate to understand the problems. But their whole approach is to assess the assets that exist even within the poorest of neighborhoods and then to build on those assets. And it's a very different way of problem solving that I think has lots of potential. So taking that exact kind of thing from the family back into the society is real exciting for me.
Deanne?
I'm really struck probably by what Sonia said about what are the places that people who care about families meet, even if we don't necessarily have the same solutions. You know, the things that we can identify as difficult, but maybe also as assets. And I think that for me, when I listen to the rhetoric that comes from the conservative side, whether that's religiously based or not, the thing that I find most troublesome is the expectation of perfection. That the way these people set it up, I know that neither the family I grew up in, which works pretty well, and the family I'm now in, which I think that I have in my household, which I think works pretty well, and my larger circle of friends who I think of as family work pretty well, but none of us are perfect. You know, I could real quick say, oh, here are 10 things about the family I grew up in that I would think aren't so great. And our current household and my, you know. And I can't think of one family I know of, however that's configured, how many parents, whether or not there are children, whether there are other people. And it's interesting with my son, I have an adult brother who lives 50 miles from us. And sometimes he comes home from school with a picture of our family that has three people, his mom and dad and him, and sometimes it has four people because sometimes it has his uncle in it. No, he kind of knows that this is a fluctuating thing, but a reliable adult who's part of his life. But I know that these are not perfect. And so if the person who's telling me, and I think that's the right verb, telling me what I should do, expects perfection, I'm likely not to listen. Because, and partly that's comes out of my theological anthropology, which doesn't expect perfection. I have that simile used as that peccator, we are still justified and still sinning. And so it's hard for me to learn from those people, even though sometimes I might agree. I guess the other thing I want to say about it, they expect perfection and uniformity. And that I know of some situations where uniformity to their model would not be a good thing.
Can I respond?
Sure.
Just two comments. One is, I have made, among many other decisions related to this issue, I make lots of personal decisions as a parent. I make lots of decisions that all of us make as parents or grandparents or those who work with children. But I've also made a political decision. And the political decision that I've made is it's my judgment that the best hope that we have of saving the world is looking at it through the eyes of children. And I've made the political judgment that there are, you know, on the one hand, I really agree with Maury, who I quote Snoopy in here, when Snoopy says, I love humanity as people I can't stand. In the same way, we love children, but we really hate children. We really don't like children in our behaviors. But in another way, the concern that I sense out there all over this country is very deep and very real about what's happening to children and the concern about the future. So in this book, I'm really making expressing a political hope that the world of our children is falling apart, and even the very world. I mean, if we take environmental issues seriously, we will not rob our children of the ozone that they need, right? We will live differently. And so I'm trying to make a case in this book that those of us who are really concerned about children, there are a lot of places that we're going to have to learn to talk to each other. And I think if we can't do it through the lens of children, I think we're doomed. I think that's our best hope. That's my political judgment. Second comment, briefer, is that, and this gets close to what Maury said too, I think it's very important for us to realize that families and children are in trouble in society among all social classes and groups. What that means is that even our vision of the good life, those of us who have some power to follow through, those of us who aren't poor, are making really poor decisions when it comes to what we allow our culture to tell our children, how we advertise them to them, what we tell them the meaning of life is, the models that we give them to live. And I would add to that, we rarely ask our children to live beyond themselves. We rarely give our children a stake in the future and say that they are powerful people with us that are going to help right these wrongs, and I think we need to do that. I think the religious right is right about at least one thing on this issue, and that is that they sense that there's something fundamentally wrong. There's something fundamentally wrong. The problem is that insight gets destroyed for me in the kind of fundamentalism that you're talking about. There's a rigidness there. There's a meanness that grows out of that. But they're right that something is fundamental wrong. And that's a starting point where I think that we can really talk with each other.
There was a hand right next to Deanne.
That's because Deanne used the word uniform, uniformity. And I've long thought that the phrase family values is loaded. Every family has values. The mafia family has values. Its value is controlling crime and gaining wealth. And until we learn to accept that I'm not the only one with family values, then we're not going to do what Sonia suggested, which is to help people love themselves and each other and have value. So that's just my input, is that every family has values, and we may disagree with some of them.
I think talking about how this expectation of perfection, and I see that too. And I think where we can be the body of Christ is to go, okay, this world isn't perfect. We've got single moms. Not how can we stop them? How can we support them? Okay, this world's imperfect. We've got kids who feel terrible about themselves. Girls who are struggling awfully with eating disorders. Boys who are turning to crime and to gangs to find support and to find a sense of self and a sense of involvement. How can we come and provide that for them in a safe way and in a way that affirms them? We've got a terrible welfare system. Poverty stinks. The welfare system stinks. It's not working. Let's say, you know, the religious right says cut money, cut funds. You know, let's take a serious look and revise the system that's there. Be willing to say the system stinks. We've made mistakes. We're not helping people. A lot of our programs aren't good. Let's make them better. Not expect perfection, but see imperfection and see what we, you know, sort of the middle ground. Things can get better. How are we willing to be involved? And I'm encouraged that, you know, hearing from you, Maury, and from you also about people who are acting locally, you know, thinking globally. We don't like the condition of our country, of our world. We don't like what's happening to families. And we're doing something about it. And that's what I think is great. And if we can do that in a way that loves and affirms people who have made mistakes, who have gotten kicked and bruised, and we can affirm one another, I think we see change, definitely. And I'm encouraged by that. And when I see that, I get to celebrate it, because it's not always there.
At the risk of jingoism and other kinds of black and white stereotypy, I'm going to venture this. I think there's a real paradox in the kind of discussion that we're having about the way I would like to see myself, like, just as you were saying, supporting people who are having difficulty, helping with programs, helping people help themselves. Those are all things that appeal to me and naturally then put me on the political left hand. What I observe from the political right is that, so intrinsic in that is that I tend to like inclusive language, or I'm adopting this term, expansive language, and try to bring more and more people into the fold and willing to listen to other people's opinions. But what I see from the political right is that they are very willing, and there's the they part, I'm sorry to do that, but they're very willing to impose their thinking on me when I want to hear other people's thinking and so forth. So we have a dichotomy in that people who hold those views are very willing to vote in favor of their thinking imposing something on me, whereas we tend to not do that. We tend to vote in favor of programs and support. I don't know if I've made that point, but it to me it's very frightening. The very nature of how we are tends to allow someone else to impose things.
Well, look, you think of Focus on the Family, you mentioned Dobson. Focus on the Family, which is the religious, the largest family organization probably in the country, has $105 million a year budget. And much of that money, in one way or another, is invested in very clear political objectives of taking over local school boards, of teaching, the way we're going to solve the family crisis is to get prayer and Mormonism. Make sure that gay and lesbian people can't be legally married. There's a whole political agenda there that I think really needs to be responded to. And one of the ways I think we need to respond to it, it's very interesting growing up. I live in Minneapolis, as I said. We're part of a Lutheran church. We're also part of an alternative faith community that some of you may have heard of, the community of St. Martin. It really founded by people who were here at Holden Village for many years, and when they left, they decided they wanted to locate. Janet Grant is a member of our community, and She came here, unfortunately, for a while, but she'll be back. But one of the things that we see in community is that our children learn about issues like gay and lesbian people by knowing gay and lesbian people, rather than be, and by knowing families of gay and lesbian parents who are not any different from you or me, and maybe there are gay and lesbian parents here tonight, I don't know. The point being that one way of trying to break some of that down is in human relationship. And I get very troubled by some of the political agenda of the religious right that really does, I think, threaten to really erode the well-being economically of lots of families, put lots of pressure on, but more importantly, create environments in which hate and meanness thrive. And I think that is part of what needs to be countered.
Deanne?
I think when we think politically about these things, one of the things that the religious right is right about is that these aren't issues that only concern individuals, that we all have something to say, and that each individual or each little household isn't separate from everybody else. And that it's really dangerous to respond to the kind of retrospective lifting up of the nuclear family of the 1950s as the ideal. It's really dangerous to respond to that only out of political liberalism that says, well, it's right for me, and this is what's right for me, and what's right for you is what's right for you. Because that's precisely what gets us in a problem where nobody can help each other. And that's, I think, one of the things that's really creative and exciting, both about the community of St. Martin and this Healthy Family, Healthy Communities initiative, is trying to figure out ways to be supportive of each other, sometimes only strategically, and sometimes with fundamental commitments in common. I mean, something like making sure that children have enough to eat. You don't have to have much else in common to figure out ways you can work together to make sure that children have enough to eat. But I'm also always, I feel like I always have to say this, I also don't like it when we talk about families and we only talk about children. Because I think families are much bigger than children, and people who don't have children but are adults are still parts of families. And so that tendency we have to reify family into issues about children, which are very important issues, impoverishes our discussion about
them. I just want to throw in something on that, because I was earlier this evening in the same room with the session that Buddy Mendez was doing on marriage. His title was, So Now You're Married, What Next? And it was very interesting because he brought a lecture, but he didn't give it. He asked people in the room, who ranged from people who weren't married to people who had been married for a year to people who had been married 56 years. In fact, they're sitting in the same exact chairs they were. And he said, what are the issues you've dealt with in your marriages? We put all those up on the board. And then he said, so how have you dealt with those issues? And people talked about all the ways they dealt with those issues. And then at the very end, the last 2 minutes of the session, he says, well, I did a whole bunch of research and read all these articles that talked about successful marriages. And let me read you the 12 things that they said were most important for marriages to be successful. And sure enough, every single one of those 12 issues came out of that discussion that the group had had. And primary among them was commitment and trust, which I thought was very interesting, because partly the reason I'm going off in this direction is Deanne talking about families without children. And I'm married, and I think of my wife and I as being a family, but we don't have children. And so this is really important to me, this question of commitment and trust. And I think that if that's a component of healthy marriages, then it certainly makes sense to me that it would be important for a healthy public life that there be some commitment to a relationship to the community, and that there be some way to build trust among people in community. So
for whatever that's worth, I saw this very interesting connection between what makes a healthy relationship in a home and what makes a healthy relationship in a community or in a society.
You know, I think I feel that I'm in a group of middle-class people here. We're talking about making commitment, talking about values that need to be imparted by parents. I don't argue with that. But people have been up here who minister to Mexican farm laborers. And they tell me that the parents, two-parent family with three kids, in that two-parent family, maybe both parents have two jobs. And so the point I'm trying to make is that as we're talking here about values and commitment, those people have to make a commitment to get food on the table. And the numbers of those people are increasing every day. And if there's not going to be a commitment on our part, through our government, I think that's the only way it can be, to give people at least the opportunity, as Riva had when she was raising her children, of being able to live in poverty, but still being able to have an opportunity even to impart values that we're kind of wasting time talking about a major part of the problem. I do hear you saying that, well, there are problems in the rich suburbs, and I agree with that.
But I think your point is really, really well taken. And, you know, one out of every four children in this country are now born into poverty, and the fastest growing rate of poverty in the country among children is among children who live in families where at least one of their parents is a full-time worker. One out of five U.S. full-time, this never enters the welfare debate, one out of five full-time workers in this country lives in poverty. That's the issue. And for me, if I were to say one word to describe why we're in crisis, I guess it would have to be more than one word, but it has to do with community, the absence of community, the breakdown of community. And in my view, what is most breaking down community in our country right now, in our world right now, is the globalization of the economy. And we treat it as a god, and it is shredding apart, it's ripping to shreds community after community in this country. And eventually we're going to have to come to terms with the economic aspects, I think this is what you're suggesting, that are ripping families and destroying choices. The number of women in this country that work three jobs has escalated dramatically in the last 10 years, by way of example. So our images of welfare, lazy welfare mothers out there, I mean, there may be a few, there may be some, but I would ask us to ask, the question I pose in this book is, isn't it convenient that the rich have us focus so much attention on the poor, and so little attention on what they've been doing and what they continue to do?
There was a hand back here.
A question that I have, I don't have an answer to, I'm interested in some responses, is from comments I've heard coming from the right that get me thinking in talking about the family issue, is that they have a perspective of what an ideal family is, and they feel everybody in the United States should be, at least some of the more vocal ones, think everyone should be fitting that model, and a lot of people who have problems with that. On the other hand, I don't think there'd be many people who agree that an ideal family situation is not a 14-year-old unwed mother who's got a child. And the question that I have, and is really puzzling me, is when you're talking about the situation of families, at what point does one try to not only support all the family situations that are out there, but also try and work towards more beneficial family situations, and not simply say, anybody who has a family needs to be supported, it's all okay, and there are some things that we ought to work towards, and here's a better situation for people to be in. And that's a tricky situation, because the same ones who would say that the only proper family is a husband and a wife, and that's the only one there should be, and yet we want to support all the other families that are out there, shouldn't there be some distinction somewhere, and if so, where? And I don't know if there is an answer.
It sounds to me like that you have a sense of an answer in your question, that you think there are some forms of family that are more nurturing and more helpful to raising of children than others, and that you see some importance in that. So I'm just curious to hear you.
Well, I don't think that, to me it's obvious that a 14-year-old unwed parent is under a lot of pressures that, and so much when we were talking about the marriage session earlier, we're talking about different types of pressures and stresses on the family. That doesn't sound like the most successful situation for raising a child and a family. I mean, both of them are children at that point. And to me, I guess I am coming across with a bias and saying that I don't think that is the best situation. And maybe the question is for myself. I have feelings that some situations work better than others, but I am honestly confused as to at what point there is a difference, and does that matter in the whole debate at all? Does it matter that I think some are better than others?
I think it matters a lot, and I don't know anyone who thinks it's a good idea for 14-year-olds to be having children. And I work with a lot of progressive midwives who are part of our community that are really alarmed at how many young people come to them and who are 13, 14 years old, who are really frustrated because they cannot get pregnant. So it's a very real issue, and it's a terrible problem. But then, having stated that, I think we have to try to deal with those people. But then we also have to recognize a couple of things. For example, the political right in this country, their take on teenage pregnancy is that the welfare system encourages teenage pregnancy. Well, the statistics would say the states that offer the greatest welfare benefits have the least teenage pregnancy. So the theory doesn't hold. So if you want to respond to that problem, which I think is a very, very real problem, the way you deal with it is not to think that getting $18 more a month than what you get in Mississippi is luring people to welfare. So that's one thing. And then the third thing I think we need to recognize is that less than 1% of all the AFDC money, which is not a lot of money, it's about $13 billion a year, federal money, compared with $51 billion tax credits for people who write off home mortgage deductions, most of it going to the upper, the richest 20% of U.S. incomers, just by way of comparison. It's not a lot of money, and it's less than 1% of the recipients who, in fact, are 14 years old. So the reason I'm saying that stuff is because I think you've hit something very, very important. It's a real problem. It's a real issue, and it needs to be responded to. It's awful having 14-year-olds getting pregnant. The other thing we have to deal with is most of those 14-year-olds who are getting pregnant are being impregnated by adult men.
Right.
It's really not teen pregnancy. There's something else going on there. So there's a whole lot of issues that come up. My fear is that by focusing, I think we need to focus some attention there, but by focusing a lot of attention there and using it as a basis to justify an end to welfare or cutting off welfare or blaming, what I see happening in the country now is that the poor are not only being blamed for their own poverty, they're being blamed for bankrupting the country. And what that covers up are the real deep political and economic crisis that we face as a country that, in my view, has much more to do with the priorities of the upper 1% than it does with this 1% of people who are the people who are getting AFDC, that 1% that are 14 years old.
I'd like to hear from people who haven't spoken yet, so why don't we go back here and then over here.
So many thoughts are going through. Jack addresses the global issue, and I think we all understand that. The idealism that Deanne addressed is a concern. When we look at the practices of the religious right, their rhetoric and their practices are two different things. They keep talking about the values, family values. And I'd like to come down to what I feel is a microcosm of a global issue that has happened right in our own county, in our own congressional district, our state legislative district. In our area, we do have a lot of poverty, a lot of teenage pregnancy. But the religious right group, many more fundamentalist churches are springing up all over the place. They are not addressing a community problem. They're condemning all of the factors that we've discussed tonight without adding to a solution. Their solution is to take their children out of the public schools and do homeschool so that they're not associated with those people. And we recently had a very alarming situation to us personally and a number of good people around our area where we had a state representative, state legislator, who was doing a marvelous job. She was just, she was elected 2 years ago, and she, we work, I'm on the Citizens Advisory Committee for Welfare Reform in our county. And I called her on the floor of the legislature one time, and she said, I really don't know that much about it. Tell me about it. What can I do? I need to know the issues. I'll send you a copy of the bill. What's up? And we've had a marvelous conversation and communication. She's open. She's just wonderful. However, in the primary election this past spring, the fundamentalist churches put up a man who knew nothing about any issue, and he zeroed in on one item, and that was the fact that our friend Jeanette made the comment about abortion, that she's against abortion personally, but she is not going to interfere with a woman's right to choose. That issue defeated her in the primary election. That alone defeated her. So we need to take a look at the power that these people have and the danger of what they're doing. They just defeated a wonderful, open-minded, broad state legislator to put in a very narrow-minded, relatively ignorant, single-minded person. And I'm afraid of that.
That's an example of what I was saying earlier about, as a population, we tend to be expansive and supporting people's right to think and so forth, but from the very right side, we have a strong willingness to impose their personal values on all the rest of us. Sorry.
I guess I was just going to say, I know there's so many factors, you can't always talk about all the factors, but one which I feel that both the liberal and the fundamentalist community, the white liberal and white fundamentalist community, there's a deafening silence is in regards to white racism. And it is only if both communities lean upon race will there be an ability for us to look at how deeply it's ingrained in each one of us, that on the daily, you know, the daily struggle to deal with our own prejudice when we walk down the street and be willing to say that to some other Christian and struggle with it. And I think that's a connecting point that, you know, and you talked about the breakdown of the families. Well, 200 years ago, the white community, we started and we've been continuing to just mess with African Americans, particularly. I was in a group recently where they were talking about how, in a way, that, you know, there's degrees and African Americans still are on the bottom. We're not dealing with it at all. We don't raise it at all. We don't identify it at all. And so that the discussions now that we're talking about, which families are we talking about? Because there's very specific, different historical, the whole bit is so different. I mean, there's genocide going on among young African American men.
in a way in which it was happening within our white community, you know, there, we would have the National Guard out, you know? I mean, there would be the National Guard, and there would be some major, but there's no outcry in the white community whatsoever. And I really think that the only way we can deal with it is if we, you know, accept the grace of God.
It's a powerful statement, and I would like to claim that as the concluding statement, at least for the conversation in this room. And I hope that you've heard provocative things, maybe things that you'll follow up on with the person who said it in conversations later. But at least at this point, let's call an official close and thank our panelists. And then if you'd like to stay and continue to talk, you can choose to do so.